Hello, and welcome to the EcoMedics podcast, where we explore how the health of our planet affects the health of the people on it, and how we, as healthcare professionals, have the power to lead the way in curbing the climate crisis and to be pioneers in building sustainable healthcare systems. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Ashling, a junior doctor and member of the EcoMedics team, and we have an incredible lineup of guests who will be joining me on each episode to share their experience and expertise about health and the environment. For this episode, I'm excited to introduce Chantelle Rizan to join us. Chantelle is a trailblazer in researching and advocating in the field of sustainable surgery. With a clinical background in ear, nose and throat surgery, she has a special interest in environmental sustainability and took time out of training to become the UK's first sustainable surgery fellow. Chantelle is currently undertaking a PhD at Brighton and Sussex Medical School, where she's conducting in-depth research around reducing the environmental impacts of common operations in the UK. She is quickly becoming a well-respected leader in this field, and her academic work is creating a much-needed evidence base from which a transition towards sustainable surgery is gaining momentum. A huge thank you for joining us, Chantelle. It's a real privilege. How are you?
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. It's an absolute pleasure to join you today.
It's also a pleasure to meet a fellow colleague from Brighton and Sussex Medical School, which is where I trained. And Brighton has always been really forward thinking when it comes to the environment and sustainability. Obviously, it's a green party hub, recently crowned the vegan capital of the world. So it's amazing to hear that that's where you're carrying out your research.
Yes, absolutely. And I think I only have to look around me and be absolutely inspired and in awe of nature. I'm fortunate enough to be able to see the sea right now from where I'm sat. I'm right at the top of the hill. There's the South Downs. And so I think with that in mind, it does just attract a whole body of people that do have that appreciation of the natural world. And when I came to Brighton around 7 years ago, I did find that there were certainly a growing number of people that had a real interest in sustainability and indeed within the healthcare setting as well. And there's just been such a growing momentum and such a growing body of people in this area specifically who are actually really engaged in making things happen.
That's so exciting to hear. And I understand you've had a real love for nature and protecting the environment from a very young age. I'd love to know about how this has developed over the years and if that has had a big impact on the work you're doing in sustainability now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think as long as I can remember, I spent a lot of time in the great outdoors, and right from the age of three, I had my first pair of walking boots, and I'd be sort of up in the hills with my family, and was very fortunate to have been introduced to the great delights of the outdoors from an early age. And that really did stay with me through childhood, and I picked up some various interests and projects in terms of conservation, and did some work on overfishing when I was very young, and wrote actually an extensive manifesto on overfishing, and I was only 12 years old and it was 28 pages long, so probably wow. Had a bit of an inclination that I might have gone on to become an academic of sorts and go on to write a thesis, but that's where I started from. But really, when I became a junior doctor, I didn't quite see how those two paradigms aligned, and how that interest could actually translate into my clinical work. And it was only really when I did a Master of Research and I was looking at streamlining patient pathways and using lean management to actually look at ways to optimize whole patient pathways that I saw that actually when we have these lean models of care, that there are actually environmental savings as well. And when we're looking at financial savings, then that we're looking at maximising our resource uses. And so realise that actually this is that link then in terms of how we can actually improve the sustainability of services that we provide within healthcare. And at the time when I was working within operating theatres, I recognised that we're a really resource intensive area. And of course, we generate a lot of waste in each and every single operation that we do. And at the time I saw that actually there was very little evidence out there in terms of what we could do to transition to sustainable surgical systems and to actually mitigate our environmental impact. And so I saw this as a great opportunity to actually focus my PhD research on evaluating those ways that we can actually mitigate the carbon footprint of surgical services.
What is it that you feel it sort of drives you at the moment then in terms of the link between healthcare and sustainability that makes you feel that we really need to be focusing on that right now?
So I think we must remember first and foremost that climate change is a healthcare issue, and it's been posed by the Lancet Countdown as the greatest threat to human health of the 21st century. And it is our core business as doctors, and we can't provide healthcare today at the expense of future generations and those who are perhaps separated in developing countries who are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. And so I think with that in mind, it's our absolute duty, and we can't provide healthcare without placing sustainability and addressing health inequalities at the very centre.
And can you tell us a bit about the work that you're doing at the moment?
Absolutely. So I'm right in the final few months now of my PhD. So I'm writing up my thesis, but that's based on a whole body of work that I've been developing over the last few years, which really focuses on the products that we use within the surgical operating theatre. So we know that in terms of when we provide surgical care, then the main hotspot areas relate to the energy consumption relating to heating, ventilation and air conditioning, as well as the anaesthetic gases we use. But another key hotspot area is the consumables, so the products that we're using. And that's a really key area that we actually have got quite a lot of control over as clinicians in our day-to-day working life. And so it's an area that I essentially decided to focus on within my research. And really, if we look at operations as a whole, I found that actually there's just a few products that predict the majority of the carbon footprint of a single operation. And so my work looks at identifying those so that when we look to actually make actions, that we're focusing on those biggest areas, because there's all sorts of people that are getting interested about improving sustainability, but we need to focus and target those efforts towards the products that are going to have the biggest impact. And oftentimes those are items that are single use, and they're often plastic, they're often very bulky. And so it's then looking at ways that we can actually reduce that. So either looking at not using them at all if there's opportunities for reduction, and then it's thinking about switching these to reusables. And part of my work, so I look at removal of a gallbladder, so a laparoscopic cholecystectomy, and I find that there's just three products that are responsible for 18% of the carbon footprint. So that's in and amongst hundreds of items, there's just three that are actually a real key culprit.
Do you mind just saying which ones they are?
Yeah, absolutely. So laparoscopic ports, as well as laparoscopic scissors and clip pliers. So I did some research essentially looking at some hybrid alternatives that are predominantly reusable with a small single use component. And these essentially reduce the carbon footprint of those three products by 75%. And this was a full life cycle assessment, which essentially takes into account all stages of those products' production through their manufacture and distribution. And for the reusables, it takes into account the sterilization and the waste disposal as well at the end. And so hopefully that shows how actually from having that really targeted approach to look at the products that actually have the greatest impact, we can then do more detailed studies to look at ways to actually reduce that, and actually huge reductions there of 75% from that single switch. And I looked at what would happen if we actually used those three products for all lap cholecystectomies in England, and found that it would save the equivalent of me driving over 1 million miles in an average petrol car in a single year. And there were financial savings as well of around 11 million from that simple switch. So something that's really easy to do.
That's incredible. And you're so dedicated to this work. And as you said, you're mapping out the carbon footprint in so much detail, going literally from the manufacture of the materials and then to the use in the operating room. Has it been challenging doing this? Have you had sort of a framework that you're able to work from, or has it literally required you to start from scratch obtaining this kind of information?
Absolutely. It's been very challenging, but also very enjoyable. And I think this academic field is right at its infancy, which has been a great opportunity to actually shape the way that some of these things are done. But when I came to start, I found that some of those fundamentals were missing. So I wasn't able to account appropriately for waste or sterilization. And so I actually did some original studies looking at the carbon footprint of healthcare waste and on the carbon footprint of steam sterilization of our reusable equipment, to quantify that. And hopefully that then forms a foundation for other people wanting to do research in that area. I didn't only quantify the actual impact, I was also looking at ways to optimize those processes, because it's no good just having a carbon footprint associated to these things. It's really about how we can actually make a real change in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions in the real world. And I found that we could actually, within sterilization, optimize that by around a third. And that was through things like preparing our instruments as sets rather than as singly wrapped supplementary items, as well as optimizing the loading of our machines that we use, and switching to renewable energy sources and recycling of the sterile barrier systems. But within this sort of research, we have to engage with all sorts of people from lots of different backgrounds. And I think within the operating theatre, we often don't think about those underlying processes, such as the upstream processes within the supply chain and the steam sterilization, the linen laundering and waste and so on. So it's been a really interesting journey to actually spend time in these different settings and really learning from people from all sorts of different backgrounds.
It sounds like it really is quite a big project, because there's so many aspects to take into consideration. So you've mentioned there about the materials that are used, the sterilizing of equipment, the energy sources that are being used, I'm assuming for the machinery, for lighting, and then waste and management of that waste. In terms of the equipment that's being used, you mentioned a few things about sort of reusable parts of the equipment. Are there certain machines and equipment that you've noticed that really are driving our carbon footprint up within the operating theatre? Any specific ones?
So when it comes to energy consumption within the operating theatre, there was an excellent study by a colleague in Canada called Andrea McNeil, and what she found was that actually the majority of the energy consumption related to the heating, ventilation and air conditioning, so really the maintenance of the operating theatre. And she also looked at the impact from lighting and from plugging equipment into the mains, and that had a much smaller impact. So really, when it comes to our energy consumption, the biggest opportunity for change comes at the stage of the theatre design, as well as looking at retrofit. But really, this is in the realms of engineers, and it's something that needs to be planned when we're actually building hospitals. But there are opportunities. So within that, we need to be looking at putting in occupancy sensors so that things only come on when we need them, and actually looking at reducing the airflow turnover. Of course, using renewable energy sources will be important there, and having those buildings with improved energy efficiency. But I think on a day-to-day basis, as a jobbing clinician, then actually our opportunity to have an impact really does lie in terms of the things that we choose to use and the things that we choose to procure as well.
How have you translated some of these findings that you've come across? How have you translated that? Has it been in the form of protocols and best practice procedures that are then being introduced across the trust? Or how do you expect that we can really make the most difference with these outcomes?
So I've been fortunate enough to have been working in this space, I guess, from from the start, I've been one of the early people working within this field. And I was invited to present to the Council of the Royal College of Surgeons of England back, I think, in 2018, maybe 2019, and went on to actually co-found the Sustainability in Surgery Working Group at the Royal College of Surgeons. And this has been an amazing opportunity actually to actually use my research to inform our national policy. And we've gone on to develop a sustainable surgery strategy from the Royal College. And right now, I'm actually at the very start of a very exciting project with the UK Health and Climate Change Alliance. And I'll be the academic advisor for a national report on meeting net zero within surgery. And this is a 2-year project, and we've appointed a fellow to actually help us in the writing of this report recently. But we're really taking a very intercollegiate approach and trying to take into account also the whole surgical ecosystem. And when I say that, I mean the full multidisciplinary team, as well as all of those supporting supporting processes and engaging with industry and so on. So it's very ambitious, but essentially within that, we're looking at the existing evidence in terms of how we can actually reduce our environmental impacts, and also identifying those areas that we need further innovation. And then, of course, more importantly, perhaps, is the implementation phase in terms of how we translate what we know works and what we know will actually help us in our target of meeting net zero, and actually translating that into practice.
And what are some of the main outcomes that you would say have come from your work that you've done so far? You mentioned a few of them there about the sort of key parts of surgery where you can really make a huge impact. Is there anything else that's come out? Anything that maybe surprised you?
So I think some other interesting work which has been of more broad interest to the whole of healthcare, but also I suppose to the public as well, has been some work that I've been doing in relation to PPE. And during the pandemic, I looked at the environmental impact of the PPE that we used during the first 6 months. And there I found that actually we generated over 100,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalents in just that 6 month period. And if we think about that in relation to flying, this would be the equivalent of me flying from London to New York over 240 times each and every single day. So huge impact. It's around an additional 1% burden in terms of our NHS carbon footprint. But within that work, I looked at how we could actually mitigate that and to reduce this. And I found that we could actually optimise that by around 75% through a combination of strategies. And they included things like domestic manufacture and rationalising our glove use, switching to reusables, so reusable gowns and reusable face shields, as well as recycling. But I think one of the really interesting and surprising findings from that work was what happened when I modelled what would happen to the carbon footprint if we used air freight. And so air freight is used within quite a lot of our healthcare supply chain.
And do you mean sort of procurement of our supplies by air?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was used quite commonly in the start of the pandemic, but actually we see it throughout other areas within our the things that we buy. They actually come from the manufacturer to the UK by plane. And within that research looking at PPE, I found that single action alone increased the carbon footprint by 50% compared to shipping. And so really the take home message there is that we need to eliminate air freight from all of our healthcare supply chain. And when we have industry representatives coming into our hospitals and we have those opportunities to speak to them, actually asking that question and trying to push the message that actually that it's not acceptable and it's not something that we want within our supply chain. We're used to operating on a model where we have things just in time, but actually if we plan sufficiently, then using shipping in the majority of cases is actually suitable.
And that's quite relevant, obviously, with COVID still not fully gone and are still needing to use a lot of PPE, I don't really think we've come away from that just yet. We're still using masks, we're still using lots of gloves and aprons, which we prior to the pandemic weren't really using. That sounds like it's really going to have a really important impact going forward. I actually just wanted to ask about surgery in general and the carbon footprint of surgery. Is there a way that you can describe to us how carbon intensive surgeries are? And I know your research focused specifically on five common surgeries. Are you able to illustrate for us what kind of impact those surgeries have on the environment?
Yeah, so if we think about a typical operation, it generates the equivalent of driving around 400 to 650 miles in an average petrol car. And that was based on average emissions in three different countries. So comparing the US with Canada versus UK. So those are relatively typical contributions, and that's for a single operation. And we know that there's evidence from the Sustainable Development Unit, which has gone on to become the Greener NHS, that our single-use products that we use within the operating theatre were really highlighted as one of the top 20 types of products that have got high greenhouse gas intensities. And we're also a lot more energy intensive than the rest of the hospital. We're around six times more energy intensive. And so on a number of levels, we're really resource intensive, both in terms of the energy that we use and the amount of stuff that we use, so the consumables and the products that we're actually using. We also generate a lot more waste than the rest of the hospital. But really, when we think about waste, it's really about the embodied carbon upstream. It's the carbon is relating to the single use items and the raw material extraction and the actual production of those items. Whereas the processing of that waste itself isn't really the problem. We know that for the NHS as a whole, there's just 5% of our carbon footprint of the NHS relates to waste. And so even if we recycle optimally, that's not going to get us anywhere near meeting net zero. And it's really looking upstream and actually seeing for those opportunities where we can actually make reductions and where we can transition and switch to low carbon alternatives that we're going to have a bigger impact.
That's so interesting that you say that, because I think you kind of assume that waste is such a huge part of it, but that's so interesting that a lot of the burden is upstream and the actual manufacturing and the single use.
Yeah, we will see a benefit though from recycling if we actually increase the recycled content of the products that we use within the healthcare context. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean when we recycle in healthcare, we often use those materials in other industries. So, for example, if I recycled a really high quality stainless steel instrument, it wouldn't then be used for another surgical instrument. It would then be typically used in the construction industry. And really that's downcycling. So it's being used for a lower grade purpose. But if we were to actually use recycled materials within our healthcare products, then we would start to see a benefit. But we're quite a way off that now. But there might be opportunities, for example, when we think about our aprons that we use, there's absolutely no reason why they couldn't be made from a recycled low-density polyethylene in the same way as we have recycled carrier bags. And so there is lots of opportunity there. And in fact, when I conducted my research, it's in the rather exciting Journal of Cleaner Production, which looked at the carbon footprint of healthcare waste, and there I found that actually there was a 50-fold impact on in terms of the carbon footprint of the waste itself when I compared high temperature incinerations, that's our yellow bagged clinical waste, versus recycling. So the take home message is it's important that we do dispose of our waste correctly, but it isn't going to exempt us from those wider issues, and really reduction and switching to reusables is going to have a much bigger impact than recycling. We can't simply rely on it.
And those figures that you mentioned earlier, sort of that, the miles in a car that a common surgery might equate to, what kind of reduction can we expect to see with some of the alternatives that you've been researching?
Well, I think it's a bit difficult to say because there are just so many different components and there are so many different assumptions essentially that are made. But ultimately, we need to be having that clear ambition in mind that we need to be meeting net zero by 2050, ideally by 2045, and to include within that the whole of the healthcare supply chain. And so that's really the end goal in mind, but it's not going to be from a single set of 10 measures. It's going to be cumulative action, and it's going to require the engagement of each and every clinician and decisions that are made on a day-to-day basis that actually help us to get there. I am very happy to talk through an overall sort of strategy in terms of the sorts of things that we might think about, but really the reduction that we need to make is to net zero.
And what does net zero in surgery look like?
So if we were thinking about a vision of net zero, then of course we need to be using renewable energies and optimising the energy side of things. But the strategy that we need to take when it comes to products is then to look for opportunities for reduction, for switching to reusables. We need to be optimising our sterilisation process, and if we're really stuck with single use, there are also opportunities for reprocessing where we actually reverse engineer products and we actually enable a further use of them before they're disposed of, and then finally moving on to recycling. But I think when we're thinking about mitigating our carbon footprint of surgical services, we need to bear in mind that we're going to have an even bigger impact if we look upstream in terms of surgical disease prevention and health promotion and trying to prevent that individual from becoming a surgical patient in the first place. And what we've been talking about today has been mainly at the point that care is required, but we're going to have a much bigger impact through looking upstream. And a lot of the areas that we can think about actually have got co-benefits to human and planetary health. And so, for example, when we've got a patient, we're trying to optimise them for surgery, or we're trying to optimise their surgical condition. If we encourage active transportation and we encourage things like reducing red and processed meat consumption, that can then reduce the individual's carbon footprint and their own personal impact on the environment whilst actually improving their health outcomes. And I think we need to bear in mind as well that when we think about sustainable models of healthcare delivery, it's about providing the best quality care that we can. And if we're providing care at the right time for the right individual, that essentially minimises any unnecessary care. And so, for example, if we reduce the complication rates, then this, and we encourage smoking cessation, for example, which we know is associated with higher postoperative complications, then that actually reduces the need to manage those complications. And that, of course, has its own carbon burden as well. So I think in terms of your original question, in terms of that overall vision, then it's really taking that step back and thinking about how we can manage our patients optimally.
And that's so interesting because I find that no matter who I've been talking to about healthcare sustainability, it does always seem to come back to that. And the overarching theme that frequently comes out is about reducing sort of the actual healthcare burden to prevent the need for healthcare intervention. So essentially, as you're saying, reducing the need for surgery, and that comes from sort of healthy living, improving diets, reducing a huge number of conditions that are preventable. Because as you sort of said, the actual carbon impact of a surgery is huge in itself. So if we can actually go upstream and reduce the need for that, that seems like a really important step in the whole of the NHS moving towards net zero.
Yeah, and it's about having conversations and working with our patients to ensure that actually the operation is the best option for them, and often the best surgery is the surgery that doesn't need to happen at all, and we don't need to fix things just because we can, because sometimes that doesn't necessarily align with the individual's personal goals. And so it's having those open and honest conversations with our patients in terms of what they're wanting to achieve from their surgery, and really working out if it's the best option for them.
Holt Doctors is the number one agency for doctors seeking locum work. They have more independent 5-star reviews than any other agency. The team at Holt are some of the most experienced in the industry, dedicated to finding doctors the jobs they really want. Holt has many exclusive contracts across the UK, from Highland to Island and everything in between. This means that not only are they the best agency to find you your perfect job, but they help doctors to get ahead in their career. Holt cares for those who care. To find out how Holt can help you, join them now at holtdoctors.co.uk or download their app. Going back a little bit, are you able to talk to us about desflurane? Because I know there's been a lot of research into that. Is that, sorry if that's not an area that you focus on at all, but I wonder if you are able to share some information about that with us.
Yeah, so I'm not an anaesthetist, and my anaesthetic colleagues are much further ahead than the surgical lot in relation to both the research and then also the engagement of anaesthetists in terms of their day-to-day work. But as you say, desflurane is essentially one of the main culprits and a really high source of greenhouse gas emissions. And actually, in settings where desflurane is used, we find that that actually predominates the carbon footprint of the whole operating theatre. It's so bad. And actually, the global warming potential of desflurane is several thousand times more than carbon dioxide itself. So it's got a huge global warming potential, and it's one of the key areas that we can actually see reductions in relation to anaesthetic gas usage. And so switching to things like sevoflurane, we see reductions. Another key area relates to nitrous oxide, and actually a simple thing of checking for leaks within the pipes can see huge reductions. And if we could see all of the pounds being leaked out of these nitrous oxide pipes, then we would do something about it. But often people aren't even aware that this is happening. And there's opportunities as well for things like gas scavenging systems, and lots of innovation really coming through in relation to anaesthetic gases. And of course, switching to Teva, we anticipate that there'd be savings with that sort of thing as well.
I remember reading one study that says that using desflurane for 1 hour is equivalent to between 235 and 470 miles of driving, which when I read that, I was so shocked. I couldn't believe how much that was. And when you've given us some of the figures there about what an average operation, the output is, it does show that that is a massive, massive proportion. So as you said, it seems like it is really important to do that research to find what those hot areas are that we can pull back on. And I know you're not an anaesthetist, but does it look like there's been a transition away from some of these anaesthetic gases to either total intravenous anaesthesia or alternatives?
Yeah, I think there's quite a few trusts now that have actually effectively locked away the desflurane. And I think these nudges where we actually have to make a deliberate choice to opt for something that actually has got a much larger environmental impact is really helpful. And there's been a lot of progress, I think, on that front, particularly within the UK.
In our recent EcoMedics conference, we had a talk from surgeon Cleo Kennington, who talked a bit about the concept of local anaesthetic having a lower carbon impact, partly due to the medications used, opposed to general anaesthesia, but also in terms of recovery, the amount of analgesia needed post-op and things like that. Are you able to comment on that at all?
So there's very little formal research out there at the moment in relation to that specifically, but it is something that we are looking at developing locally in terms of looking at a life cycle assessment in relation to that, but based on understanding the processes involved and so on, then we would anticipate that there would be reductions seen in using local anaesthetics. And of course, as you say, there's also benefits to the patient and in terms of their experience of their recovery and so on. And I think that's really helpful to bear in mind whenever we're making changes within a healthcare context. It's worth thinking about the impact on the patient and the wider populations, but then actually also taking into consideration the triple bottom line. And by that, I mean the social impact. So, for example, in terms of that reduced need for them to stay in or their faster recovery period, as well as the environmental impact and also the financial impact. So that sort of framework is called the sustainable value framework. And as I say, it encourages us whenever we're making a change within a healthcare context to actually think about the impact on the patient and the populations and balancing it against the triple bottom line.
This might be a slightly rogue question, but I know there's been some interesting research being carried out in some lower resource settings in developing efficient procedures for operations such as cataract surgeries and others, mainly due to the pressures of having less resources. Do these more efficient techniques translate into reduced environmental impacts? And can we learn from the innovation coming from these settings to scale back some of the procedures we do?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been some really interesting research in this area, predominantly, as you say, relating to cataract surgery. And so there was work originally done within a UK setting by a surgeon called Dan Morris. And there he found that the carbon footprint of a cataract operation was around 100 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalents. And subsequently, my colleague at New York University, Cassandra Thiel, who's assistant professor there, she then found that the carbon footprint of the same operation, so the same cataract surgery in India, was around 6 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalent. So huge reductions.
Wow, that's a huge difference, really, isn't
it? Yeah, and when they looked at the clinical outcomes, they were also comparable. And this really does highlight, my colleague Cassie can speak a lot more eloquently than I can in relation to this, but there's all sorts that we can learn about frugal innovation and as you say, that need for resource efficiency actually driving down resource use and that then translating into environmental savings as well.
It sounds like there's so many aspects to take into consideration. How do you feel about this aim towards net zero in 2045, 2050? Do you feel that it's achievable?
I think it's been hugely encouraging to see the amount of action that has taken place. There's been such a surge actually in this last couple of years, and I think that was really galvanised by COP26. And I'm sure some of your other guests might have also been fortunate enough to have attended, but it was really fantastic and actually placed health and health inequalities at the very centre of the negotiations. There was a health pavilion. And within that, there were, I think, 13 other countries that came on board with the ambition of meeting net zero by 2050. There are around 50 countries that also committed to developing climate resilient countries. And I think things like this have given me a huge sense of encouragement that this is now a globalized movement towards sustainable healthcare systems. And I think that when we were having these conversations 5 years ago, then you were really the only person in the room, and you could probably count, you certainly knew by name everybody that was really working in this space globally. But now there are such huge numbers of people that are becoming aware of this and really that are passionate about trying to make changes. And I don't think we have a choice. We have to get there. And I think there are enough people now working on this that we will certainly make progress. And actually, I think this next few years is of vital importance. We know that we need to be making those really dramatic reductions by 2030 if we've got any chance of limiting our warming to 1.5 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that latest IPCC report, the sixth report, really has sharpened a lot of minds, and there are people really dedicated to trying to make changes over this next few years.
And what was the response from the surgical community when you first started releasing this research? Because I know you are, I'm sure there are a lot of people doing similar work, but you are sort of known to be one of the first people really taking this to another level and producing a lot of first time research in this field. Were people supportive? Have you noticed sort of change over the last 7 years in that?
Well, I think I've always been very clear that I am following the evidence. And I think that having that robust evidence-based approach in terms of my work has really helped in terms of me communicating this to a surgical audience. And within my work, for example, I actually translate those health, I translate the environmental impacts into disability-associated life years. And I think that conducting research that's been, I suppose, to the what I hope is of the highest of standards, that's really helped me to actually convey these messages, because it's not my opinion, it's based essentially on the academic research. The conversations that I was having several years ago are very different to those now. I think now most people in the room are aware of those links between human and planetary health, and most people will have seen that connection with their workplace, whereas I think several years ago that just wasn't there. And there's such growing numbers of people from all sorts of levels, to be honest, who are coming to me, who are asking what they can do. And that ranges from national bodies through to regional units, to surgeons on the ground, as well as surgical industry and so on. So it's been fantastic really to be part of that journey and see that groundswell of movement. And just to build on that, so I'm currently supervising a fantastic doctor based in New Zealand who's actually developing the first healthcare life cycle assessment database, and that looks at all of the evidence that we have to date and all of the research in the field. And what we see, and when I'm talking about the research, I'm talking about the highest quality environmental accounting, which is life cycle assessment. And what we see is that there's actually an exponential rise in terms of the volumes of research that's being generated in this field. And I've got every confidence that that will continue. And I'm fortunate to have been right at the very start and to have had a role in helping to shape this field. But there'll be many people coming along who are gaining expertise in this field. And it'd be fantastic to see this continue to grow.
That's really, really good to hear, because although there are mountains to climb when it comes to working towards sustainability in healthcare, it's also very exciting because of this opportunity for innovation that it creates. You've given some examples there about ways that we can change our surgical practices to try and become more sustainable. And we have this amazing chance to create and be imaginative in changing the landscape of healthcare to put our planet first. But of course, time is ticking in that regard. Do you think this innovation is happening fast enough?
I think we can't start soon enough. We everything that we have planned for the next few years, it needed to happen yesterday. But I think there's lots that's being done, particularly within the UK, to actually encourage and support research and innovation. And a lot of that has been driven by the greener NHS, and that's it's great to be based myself in the UK, where there is all of this going on around us.
Chantal, the work you're doing is so necessary and so inspiring, and I'm sure there will be surgeons and other health professionals listening to this podcast who are inspired to be involved. How would you recommend people become involved in this with their trusts or academically?
So there's a great network on the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare webpage, and that's the Sustainable Operating Theatre Network. And I think it's good always to connect with other people that are are like-minded, and I'd recommend, especially for junior colleagues, to actually identify, well, to firstly speak to everyone around you, and actually identify some senior colleagues who might be able to support you in those projects. But I think that whenever we're doing audits, whenever we're doing quality improvement projects, or even research, trying to tailor those projects towards environmental sustainability, or at least thinking about integrating that sustainable value framework into the work that you're doing. And I think that if everyone were to do one or two projects a year, then we'd make great change.
And actually, that's some of the work that we're trying to do with Ecomedics as well. So one of the branches that we have are currently working on is creating a quality improvement project bank, where people can sort of submit the quality improvement projects they have been doing around the work of sustainability, and to try and allow people a framework to replicate. So that's, it's really interesting that you said that, and hopefully that platform will give people something to pick up on, because I think it can be quite hard to know where to start really with this kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. We did have a national competition last year. So this was a green surgery competition, which is a collaboration between the various Royal Colleges, as well as the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare, NIHR and BSMS as academic partners there. And we invited the surgical community to submit their projects. And we actually had 30 really engaged surgical groups that submitted really high quality projects in this field. And we were able to then support six of them through a stage of actually doing some preliminary carbon footprinting of their work, and to support them through that. And that was a really successful competition that we're actually looking to replicate over this next year. And so I'd encourage anyone who is doing work in this field to keep an eye out for that. And we'd really welcome projects from all sorts, looking at that whole patient pathway, not just focusing on the operating theatre, but seeing what we can do upstream as well.
And what can we be doing practically in our everyday practice as clinicians in the operating room, on surgical wards, or just generally in the hospital to reduce our impact?
So I think each and every single time that you open anything that's single use, whether that's in whether that's in a healthcare context within the operating theatre or on wards, but also in our day-to-day life, it's about stopping and thinking and working out, do I need this many? Do I need that many napkins that I'm picking up? Do I need this at all? Is there a reusable alternative? And it's just taking that moment to pause and think, and in the operating theatre or when we're thinking about procedures specifically, we also need to make sure that we're not opening things just in case. And, you know, I certainly was guilty of that at stages of my career, where you end up opening things thinking that you may or may not need them, but actually delaying that decision to the point where you're definitely going to need it helps us to actually avoid opening things and then throwing them straight in the bin, which is really wasted in its truest sense.
I've got some quick fire questions to ask you now. If you could give one key piece of advice to people about sustainable living, what would it be?
So I think, don't be put off by being perfect. We need everyone to essentially start that journey. And so I think it's thinking about the one thing that you can do this week or this month, and to recognise that actually we need to be making reductions and we need to be improving our sustainability. But I think people are often put off about starting that if they feel that they can't be the perfect green eco warrior. So I think thinking about what feels easiest to you, and essentially making sure that on a month or a year by year basis that you are really moving in that right direction, and to do what you can essentially.
What do you wish you knew sooner?
So I think if I'd have understood that clear link between climate change and the impact on human health, then that would have really helped me to drive some of this change from an earlier stage, perhaps whilst I was still at medical school. But I think at that stage I really saw these things as quite separate, and within my personal life, it was something that was important to me, but I didn't really see how that related to clinical practice. And I think that we often, as clinicians, feel like the work that we do is exempt from these wider issues of climate change. But I think if I had have had that clear link between the impact of climate change on human health, then I would have been able to earlier on see how those two actually intersect.
That's so interesting, because I feel that I kind of had that as well, where, you know, I was trying to make these changes in my personal life, and then you just think, oh, well, for infection control reasons, I have to do X, Y, Z at work, and there's nothing we can do about it. And, you know, healthcare is necessary, so we need to keep doing what we're doing. But that's so true that now, obviously, it's becoming clear that there is lots of work that can be done within the healthcare service, and especially because of the impact of our patients, and within our duty as healthcare professionals, it is to do the best for our patients. And that's now encompassing reducing the impacts of our carbon footprint and curbing the climate crisis. And that's actually integrated now within our roles.
Yeah, absolutely. You said it much better than I did.
What will you tell future generations about your role in the climate crisis?
Well, I think I'm fully committed in terms of my future career, and I actually want to make the whole focus of my career in terms of actually providing that evidence-based approach to transitioning to net zero within healthcare. And I think that I've been fortunate to be one of the early researchers within sustainable surgery, and have actually been able to really have an impact in terms of the way that we think about sustainable surgery. So I'm very honoured to have had that opportunity, and to hopefully have helped to galvanise the surgical community into understanding not only the scale of the impact, but also understanding, more importantly, what we can actually do to mitigate our carbon footprint.
Describe to us your vision of a greener world.
So I think we need to essentially redesign everything that we make, and to essentially have that absolute appreciation in terms of our natural resources, and acknowledging that actually we live in a world of finite materials. And if we have that at the heart of the design of the things that we actually make, then we'd be designing things that essentially are designed to be durable and that will last, and that are modular by design. And by that, I mean that they're made of as fewer different types of materials as possible, and designed so that we can actually repair things, so that when something goes wrong, we don't need to just throw away the whole thing, that we can actually look at replacing just a small component. And we need to design things so that we actually plan to capture those materials and to feed them back into our system, and to use everything and to really see everything as a precious resource. And some of the sort of systems that we can use to support that, so when we're transitioning to that circular economy, is things like leasing our equipment. So instead of buying and feeling like we own things, it's actually then using them and having financial models that are based on the use of things for a year rather than actually purchasing things. And that would then incentivize manufacturers to manufacture things that are designed to last. And so really it's about trying to make sure that we don't generate any waste, and that's really the vision that I have.
Can the health sector become truly sustainable?
So we have to. We don't have any choice here. And I'm hugely encouraged by everything that has gone on over the last few years, and in particular from the creation of the Greener NHS. And I think we do have that top level support and some of the infrastructure change coming through to actually support this. And that's then been reflected more widely at COP26 and other countries coming on board. So we have to be optimistic that we will get there, and we have to be ambitious in terms of the action that we take. We're right at the start of this journey, if we're honest, and actually there are low-hanging fruits, and we need to be focusing, as I said, our action towards those areas that are going to have the biggest change now, and we're in that fortunate position where there's things that we can do that actually have got a big impact. Maybe in 20 years time, we'll be more looking at making smaller changes, but I think we've all got a big part to play right now.
Chantelle, thank you ever so much for sharing your insight with us today. As you said, the need for a robust evidence base in this field is so crucial so that we can take steps towards reducing our environmental impact. So thank you so much for all the work that you're doing in this field and inspiring others to do the same. And I really hope this episode will prompt our health colleagues to consider sustainability in their day-to-day, to have these discussions in the workplace, and I guess put some pressure on their health boards to change policy.
Thank you very much.
EcoMedics is a non-profit organisation challenging health professionals and the healthcare industry to recognise the urgency of the climate crisis and to implement change to become sustainable. To stay up to date with our projects and events, and for climate news and sustainability tips, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @eco_medics and sign up to our newsletter using the link below or by heading to newsletter.ecomedics.co.uk. Lastly, don't forget to check out our website, www.ecomedics.co.uk, where you can calculate your carbon footprint, carbon offset your unavoidable emissions, access step-by-step sustainability guides, and buy from our non-profit shop with carefully selected sustainable partners. EcoMedics is run by a team of volunteers, and all proceeds go into the running costs of the organisation. If you want to show your support, you can also donate by heading to buymeacoffee.com/EcoMedics. Thank you so much again for tuning in, and don't forget to share this episode with friends and family and on social media. We look forward to seeing you again next week for another episode. Bye for now.